Hey, welcome to the Rock and Roll Network, everybody. All right, what's going on today? This is the Blog Talk Radio. This is the K. Thompson Live Show. I'm sorry, I'm trying to get our little music going on, and my machine don't seem to want to work, everybody. Don't know why, but we can keep it moving. All right, this is Wednesday evening at the 8 o'clock hour. This is the K. Thompson Live Show. I am what's known, or who is known, as the Sun. Don't know why this computer is not working, playing the music for me, but like I said, the heck with it. Today is the 15th of November, and you are a lady.
I'm Kay Thompson, and I am your mother, and we have another exciting program today. We dealt a lot with Michael Jackson and so forth and so on, and that was last week. A lot of people are going to be wanting to talk about him this week, and if they do, we can even give out a call out number later on in the show. But I think with the Trump thing and with what's going on with Washington, I think we should talk a little bit about that, because that really is making people very nervous, especially with that dingbat from what in the southern states who's been, you know, violating all these young girls, you know, and he's still in office. So what do you think?
Right. We got, like you said, there's a lot of stuff on the Michael subject is interesting, but there is a lot of hot and just breaking news consistently going on. This breaking news has been like every day with this presidency, huh? But in particular, the latest episode, Saga of the Republicans, is that they have their Senate candidate, candidate Roy Moore, Judge Roy Moore, who is, you know, having all these problems about... It's unbelievable. You can't make this stuff up. Nope. You guys think that Hollywood has some active imaginations? You can't make up stuff. You can't make real life stuff up. And with this guy, who is, you know, I don't know. I mean, I was talking with somebody on the phone, and they said that's how they do it down south. It seems to be okay that they date 14-year-olds. Elvis Presley couldn't marry Priscilla because she was underage. Jerry Lee Lewis, right, long time ago. Jerry Lee Lewis married his cousin, who was underage, and these are Southern guys, and it seems to be that some of the people are okay with that.
Not in 2000, whatever. And
apparently, of course, not in 2000, whatever, not any time, really, if you're a person who is really a decent person. And apparently, this had been Judge Roy Moore's M.O., allegedly that he has been messing around with young girls and people coming forth saying they were have him signing their yearbook. You got to laugh because it gets so crazy.
Pathetic.
It is pathetic. You are exactly right, Ma. It gets so crazy that they told this dude not to stop hanging out at the mall, because he was harassing the young girls. Now, here's what I'm just on a rant about this. Right. Here's what I don't get. How does that even get to be the rumor about you, that you hanging out at the mall? And propositioning young girls. How does that get to even be the rumor about you? And you heard by his own admission that he said something like he always asked the girls' mothers if he could go out with them first.
Mm-hmm.
So as if that made it okay that they were underage. This is unbelievable.
No,
so,
you know what this is?
Go ahead, Mom.
This is like we are living a series on television, like one of the, you know, the serial morning shows. The ones that are going on and on and on and on, you know what I'm talking about. You know the series of morning shows about, you know, different people. Okay, the morning shows.
Okay.
I'm not talking about the, you know, the music and all that sort of thing, but you know the series.
Okay.
They're on television every single day during the afternoon. I've seen a couple of them. I'm not watching the news or, you know, doing other things, but. It's like you're in not necessarily a world of reality, you know? So it's like, you know, just constant unreality.
Right.
Because it seems to be impossible. And we're talking about the presidency of the United States of America. People need to sink that in. That's a heavy thing. The United States of America, the world. Can you envision the world? What is the world?
Okay. All right. Yeah. And also the other subject matters we're going to be talking about are, you know, Trump is back and bragging about his trip and got the greatest, most wonderfulest, fantasticalist, bestest, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious stuff in the world that he's got done. I want to talk about him. We also want to talk about you know, the Republicans attempt to go after Hillary now to try to call for an independent investigator or counsel. And also to just a quick note about all of these shootings within the last month of, I want to know what's wrong with some of these white men. Because you had Vegas, white dude killed 50 people. You had Sutherland, Texas, white dude went into the church, shot everybody up because he was mad at his mother-in-law. You just had California, crazy white dude, shot his wife, killed people, went to a school and shot people. This was all within the last month and a half. So what's going on in that particular community? They said there are a lot of angry white men out there. I don't know, but they're going around shooting up people, stuff like that. I got to get my mouse. Let me get the co-host here. Want to get our legendary newsman, Mr. Wayne Gilman. I'm sorry, Wayne, hold on for a second. We are having technical difficulties today for sure. Here we go. Let me open up your mic, Mr. Gilman. Legendary newsman, Mr. Wayne Gilman. How are you today?
Good evening, Eric. Good evening, Kay, Byron, everyone with our listening audience. Good to be on. And I don't know, I got specific instructions from Kay before tonight's show. So I just hope this is the appropriate time for me to speak.
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 Go ahead.
All right. Well, now that I can, I'm very curious to find out what Eric knows about Trump's successes in Southeast Asia and the surrounding vicinity. I just I'm just taken back. I don't know. I heard him parrot the fact that. You know, he came away with so many successful meetings and, you know, photo ops, and he released three black men from a prison in China that they're probably going to spend the rest of their lives with the key thrown away and all that business. But, you know, I'm just curious to find out, you know, because I don't think this man does anything. But if you know him better than I, you know, I'm curious to find out.
All right, Wayne. Let's welcome our resident historian, Mr. Byron Saunders. Byron, how you doing tonight? What's your take on the situation in the country?
Oh my goodness gracious! Well, hello, Wayne. Hello, Kay and Eric. My take on the situation is this: the moral arrow of the GOP is below. It's into an abyss. Because it's below degenerate. It's below depravity. It is perverted. And I don't see how a Republican Party can really escape the corner that they have painted themselves in at this particular moment, because they're damned if they do deny Judge Roy Moore. They're damned if they don't, because at the point at which the base, which is the 35%, 32% of Trump's significant support is the evangelical base. And how in the world are you going to be able to justify their moral interpretation of a Bible that says that Mary is, you know, and her relationship with Joseph is so skewered? I think they're all drinking Jim Jones Kool-Aid. And so at the point at which, you know, it couldn't happen to a better party, but, you know, it's like, at the point of which, how are we going to be even have constructive conversations about tax reform or about immigration when we can't even have a good conversation about the truth of a president who grabs women by their private parts and then acknowledges it's okay to be a pedophile?
Right. I mean, you know, by acknowledging, obviously you're saying that since he didn't say nothing about it earlier today, that's kind of his, you know, he's kind of enabling it. You know, he didn't speak up, didn't say one word about it, really. And I would assume it's kind of interesting to watch him do that dance as it is with Sessions, because he was for Luther Strange, right? So in this particular case, Trump he picked the right guy. I mean, in their realm, I mean, he picked the less, who knows what Luther got going on, but I mean, with his name, you never know, but. You know, he backed Luther. I think his name was Luther Strange, the other Republican in the primary, and
right.
He lost. And Bannon's guy won. And so I hope that this causes, I'm sure it probably won't, the hardcore ones. But I would I would come and bring into question. It would make me question Bannon's judgment if you didn't already. But then,
well, that's,
I suppose that's
question,
probably idiotic. that's probably idiotic and redundant, right? Because if you're with Bannon, that means you never question his judgment, and his judgment is okay with you. So it's just okay that, you know, he's back to pedophile. Secondly, the Republican Party. So what's this now? The list is running: Nazis, racists, traitors, pedophiles. Boy, they're doing a bang up job in the leadership role of this country.
Yeah, you know one thing. It's like the TV series of the different shows on television. That's
right.
All.
Yeah.
It's like, and it really, it's unbelievable because it's unreal. And you know one thing. I was, you know, just holding up, you know, Donald Payne. You know, your uncle's, you know, thinking of his stay in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
He was so serious and so quiet, and he was making points after point. Donald Payne would never let this go by, you know, without talking about it, and talking about it from the standpoint of a world leader, because he did so much traveling through the African countries. He knew Mandela. He talked to Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, so we need to get back to that, this kind of people, these kinds of people who are real leaders, you know, and really, I mean, respectful
well,
people. You know, you.
Kay, I'm glad you brought
Donald Trump. You know, yeah.
Kay, I'm so glad you brought that up, because, in all honesty, that era they had statesmen. You know, and
yeah,
I'm not saying
exactly.
That there aren't many in the congressional pool now. You just reminded me that a half dozen Democrats today formally unveiled their plan to seek Trump's impeachment, and that just needs to be amplified as much as possible, because people are not quietly sitting down allowing this thing to go down. But, you know, getting back to what Byron and Eric were saying, you know, I mean, when you look at the landscape of the Republican Party, you know, you would want to think that this is part of that culture that it's almost like as if they have subtly, and I can't even say subtle, they've wanted to keep it under wraps for so long, but, you know, they're bursting at the seams with every news cycle that comes about. There's not a day that goes by in which they've stepped in more expletive deleted, you know, than they did the day before. I mean, and
mm-hmm.
we even got the president's daughter coming out today talking about the the embarrassment of the immoral or the lack of morality in this in this particular contest going on in Alabama, and it just, you know, is that part of the Southern culture?
Ivanka?
I mean, is that, you know, I question.
What was she saying? I didn't know about that. What was
pardon?
She saying, Ivanka?
No,
what
she
was
she was
saying?
Totally opposed to you know, I mean, she even called her father out during the campaign. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in a very, I guess there's but so much criticism that you could give your dad when he's a megalomaniac, you know, when he's a narcissist. But, I mean, the bottom line is, it is, how do you escape that? I mean, it was memorialized. It's documented. The man, you know, mm-hmm. was into groping and pinching, and he thought it was okay, you know?
Well, you know, yeah, well, Wayne, one of the things that's really amazing that's coming out right now with respect to the mental health issue is this. We've got a bunch of 60, 70-year-old men who can't remember things, and I'm thinking maybe they've got the onset of dementia. And
now,
so
now,
ultimately,
now, now,
well,
now,
I mean, I know
I'm in that era now.
I am, too.
Okay.
I am, too, but I can remember what I said 30 days ago, where Jeff Sessions and everybody who's coming up to these committees can't seem to remember anything pertinent. So I'm starting to question whether we should pass out a test for the urine test, because at the point at which these guys are demented.
It's the ear
well,
down south.
You kind of took my – you kind of first off, real quick on what you're saying, Wayne, I find it a little ironic that Ivanka, you know, there's irony in Ivanka saying that, because if you look at a lot of the old pictures with Donald Trump and his daughter Ivanka, there's a little creep factor in a lot of the pictures that they would take together, and it's really kind of creepy. So it's just kind of there's an irony there with her speaking up. But what you were saying, Byron, and definitely Jeff Sessions, because I was noticing the same thing. I was going, you know, I meant to put up on my Facebook page yesterday, you know, you can't tell all these lies if you can't remember the lies you told. Well, and clearly, when you look at Jeff Sessions, when he says, I don't remember, there was one, I had to tape some of it, his testimony, because he said, I don't recall that meeting, but I'm sure it wasn't the context of what you're trying to say. So you don't recall the meeting, but you're positive that it wasn't anything in a bad case, it wasn't anything nefarious. This guy is completely, completely full of it. And you can see the look on his face when he's confronted with his lies, and he has to refer to his notes about the last lie that he told. It's unbelievable.
The last lie, exactly.
And then to take umbrage with people questioning him about the lies he's telling because he doesn't like them saying that he might have lied intentionally is really unbelievable. You wanted to say?
Yeah, you know, he's not full of it. He has lost it. This is an old man. An old man who's living in, I don't know what era he's living in, but he's lost it. You know, he needs to go to the nearest, you know, elder's home, you know, and sit there and play with whatever he was going to be playing with. But anyway, because of the fact that, you know, he is true. He
Jay
is really
Thompson.
True. Yeah. So I don't know.
I don't.
Toys, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay,
new toys.
Yeah, but I don't want to learn about the book.
I don't want. I don't even want somebody like that on there, even in Congress. He's talking to young people also. The young politicians coming on.
Right. Well,
you know, and you have a fool, an absolute fool.
Right.
Please.
Yes.
Well, so, I refuse to allow him to get off the hook with him claiming his memory and all that. I think that the institution he needs to be in is one where you wear orange jumpsuits because he lied, and he knows he lied. The guy is sitting there. I mean, the only reason that these guys keep they give one testimony, more evidence comes out, then they got to come and revise their testimony. This is it's unbelievable the extent to which these men committed treason. They committed treason. Idiot Don Jr. got the email from the dude at WikiLeaks who sent him this stuff. Hey, you might want to tell your dad this. 10 minutes later, his dad is saying that. These guys are unbelievable, and the people that are voting for them, they said that, you know, non-college educated people came out and voted for Trump. And I proposed this before on our show, and I'll propose it again. We need to help all you non-college-educated angry white dudes to help you get at least a JD degree, an associate's degree, so you make better decisions, so you make better informed decisions as opposed to just emotional, hateful decisions. Because even if you're a Republican that happens to stumble upon this show and one of those type of people that happens to stumble upon this show to listen to what these darkies are talking about, I would suggest that you begin to vote your interest instead of your hatred, because these people aren't for you. It's just a word of advice from somebody who you might perceive as being on the other side. But really, I'm the type of person that can't stand to see somebody being taken advantage of, regardless of what party they're in. So,
right.
Jeff Sessions, we know.
I agree. The unfortunate thing is there's so many whites, you know, that are educated in that same group that somehow – they don't show up in the polls, but they quietly, when they go in the voting booths, they'll descend and support the party faithful, and even if it goes against their own best interest, you know, because they're afraid of losing control. You know, the obviously this country is shifting in terms of its demographics, and even the last election, you know, with all that's going on with the vote here in New York, the one in Montana, the one, you know, the one in New Jersey. I mean, it's there's clearly an effort now that I hope that the momentum will continue well into the next, you know, 4 years, the most important national elections to come up, and you know, hopefully, you know, people will get it this time and learn from the errors of what happened in 2016.
Well, hopefully what the Democrats will do is, since we have these guys on the ropes, hopefully nobody else will come out with their little tell-all book that they decide that they think is a good time to tell. Or, you know, we might get some backlash with this whole sexual harassment thing, because that's a prevalent issue. It's an issue that needs to be dealt with. It's something that's dealt with in all walks of life when you have interactions between people. But also certainly in entertainment business, which they're dealing with those people, but also in the House of Representatives. You saw Donna, Congresswoman, I think Donna Spear, come out and say there are two sitting members of Congress now that have engaged in sexual harassment. And so, you know, that as they try to clean the swamp, I think some of the people that they claim they're going to clean the swamp are some of the swamp dwellers.
Yeah, they're in Congress.
Yeah. It's important. I'm still on the fence about the whole tell-all business because I think things have to come out somehow or the other. I mean, you know, there's the old adage about the truth will set you free, and no matter how much you may try to hide something and keep things, you know, under wraps, sooner or later it'll come out. I didn't get a chance to buy the book that Brazil has out now and some of the other publications that are coming to the fore, but, you know, there needs to be a purge, you know, and I just think progressive minds will be able to analyze and scrutinize, you know, the filth from what is factual, and that's it. But, you know, the deal is that – I'm sorry, what did you say?
No, I was going to say, that's great, but we need – those are usually the people that vote anyway. The people we need to vote are those ones that can be swayed. And I just have a different agreement. I mean, you know, the truth will set you free and all those things that we're told. But the reality, that's in a moral world. That's in a kind of a movie, right? Because for some reason, the bad guys up until recently have been winning. Because they don't play by the rules, so they're going to win a little bit. I'm talking about so many of the Republican moves. So, once again, I don't think that the Democrats always put our best foot forward. And certainly stuff like that, airing our dirty laundry at the wrong time, you know, and like we said, we discussed before, perhaps it was a publisher's choice to release her book. Obviously, I would, certainly if I was a business person, looking at it from a business perspective, of course that's a great timing to do that. But if you want to get things done in the party, certainly the way this country is, you know, the majority of the people in this country are not really that well educated. Certainly not educated enough where they're paying attention to politics. They're certainly not well educated enough to decipher. Listen, we got a whole state that sent a pedophile to the Senate, and they've allowed him to be a judge for years. And just okayed it. I mean, Alabama, you know, I got an opinion about Alabama anyway from way back in the day. So, to me, they're kind of in a basket all by themselves. Well, maybe with Mississippi.
Right.
And probably Texas.
Parts of Louisiana and the great state of Texas, too. You know, I mean, it's shameful, but it's a completely different culture down there. And they look at us like as if we're crazy, you know. So, it's just one of those things.
Years ago, you may want to recall during the days of the when our country was engaged in looking at West Virginia and the coal mines, and we were at that point looking at incest and acknowledging that there was inbredness that was going on in those southern states where ignorance was basically about birth control, about marrying one's cousin. And so it's not so far-fetched, folks, that we're talking about a situation where in Alabama, where we've got a culture of people who it's okay to date a 14-year-old, okay to marry or have sex. And at some point, when you go south, and you go way back up down some of them dirt roads, you're going to find a lot of cousins, you laugh, but it's true, okay?
Well, my family is south of the border, so go ahead, speak.
Yeah,
I want to hear about these things.
Wait a minute. What's your name, Byron? What are you talking about? You talking about Virginia?
I'm talking about the fact that...
Hold it. You're talking about my family. You're talking about Virginia?
Well, I'm talking about my family, okay?
Yeah.
Listen.
There was no TV.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I've been looking at a lot of old movies. This is them. And I was thinking about Gone with the Wind. Scarlett O'Hara. And that kind of nonsense with the slaves. Miss Scarlett.
Yeah, of course.
It's crazy. It is really, really insane. I mean, these Southerners, You know, some of them like that guy who fooled with the 14-year-old girl. That old man, he can hardly stand. That's embarrassing.
Every
grown white man should be embarrassed because of this jerk.
Yeah.
He's a comedy.
Yeah, I mean, comedy, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's a little sick to me that this guy, you know, to be at the mall and the kids and the security guard to be saying, yeah, that guy's been hanging out. You know, they probably didn't know that he was the district attorney, right? It probably took the one black janitor, or the black security guard that had probably been to court a couple times, got a couple tickets, and he had to go to court, and he probably came up in the conversation. This is how I think it went. He probably rolled up in the conversation with the two white dudes and said, yeah, this dude keeps coming around bothering the kids. And he said, well, that's the district attorney. I seen him in court. He tried to put me in jail. So I think that's how they recognized that it was the district attorney coming around trying to pick up the 14-year-old girls and take them to the prom. And they got him signed to somebody's yearbook. And his lawyer wants to get subpoenaed the yearbook so they can get a writing analysis. This is crazy. It's crazy, man.
It's a comedy.
And it's our money going towards this. It's our money paying for this investigation.
Right. And I'm paying for this. And this guy. And then the first ones. These people are always the first ones to talk about God, the Bible, and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And Roy Moore. They went into his background, and they said oftentimes what he did as a judge was go against a lot of the protections for victims of rape. He was trying to make it possible. He was trying to make it possible, and that's what I'm saying. He was laying the groundwork because he was engaging in this activity. He was trying to make it possible for defendants in these cases to be able to go after the records, and many times of these 13 and 12-year-old girls, to go into their history. There was one guy, this is what I saw on the news today. It's in the, I think, Atlantic. They were quoting an article in The Guardian, and they were saying that one dude was found guilty, pled guilty of raping a 12-year-old. Roy Moore tried to make it possible for this guy to be able to have to weaken the laws so it would make it possible for this guy to go into the history of this 12-year-old girl to claim that she was sexually active and had venereal diseases. Now, what kind of sick SOB does this?
I want you to call Sean Hannity and provide that information to him. You know, I want him to you know, get his response to that.
I don't even.
Well, have you heard the phrase that they say, if somebody was on fire, I wouldn't do so and so to put them out? That's how I feel about Sean Hannity.
Mm-hmm. In truth, and we have to look at history, because as much as we can laugh at it now, history has written, including the great Southern Gothic writers themselves, Tennessee Williams, and you hear the stories of how the plantation owners and their moral or immoral identity based on the treatment of slaves and poor people, and taking advantage of setting it up where they could rape, pillage, take advantage, burn down villages. So it's like this, it's not so much that we're looking at perhaps a right now what seems like today's contemporary virus, but it is born of a history that is filled with this kind of you know what I'm talking about, perversions. That's not just today. It's this history. And so now seeing the vestiges of some of that being played out. And yes, we honor the Gone with the Winds, you know, and because we, of course, none of us know nothing about birth and no babies. But let's face it, Miss Ann, and Red Butler, and you know, all of them were playing a game.
Oh, really?
They were playing a game you know, misogyny, playing a game of slavery, playing a game of poverty versus the wealth, the agrarian businesses that were created. So,
well,
you know,
if you,
Why not Beauregard Sessions, who lies? Why not Judge Ray
right.
Moore, who is engaged in this? Tennessee Williams wrote it.
Because
I'm telling you.
These guys, Byron,
exactly.
These guys, Byron, they were their own. I mean, you know, if you look at it, you broke it down, slavery and all of that. And if you, the color purple, it reminds me of something
exactly.
of the color purple. And I'll tell you what,
yeah.
I'll tell you the correlation. But, I mean, if you think of slavery in these times, these guys were their own, had their own little kingdom, right? Whatever they
yeah.
did, they wanted. You look at these plantations, they have their own kingdom. No one's around for
yeah.
miles. They own all this land, so that's their kingdom. Sometimes the amount of land was owned was maybe the size of someone's county, a small state maybe. So they were their own king. So they whatever they decided to do, get up that morning and do, was law, was okay. And so I see what you're saying about the culture of it and the historical culture of it. And I'm reminded of Color Purple because people were so there was a backlash against the movie. A lot of brothers, well, it's against black men, whoop, whoop, this and that. I didn't take it that way. I thought the movie was good. I had read the book before. But what I saw was that Danny Glover's character was acting the way he saw men of status act in that day, right?
Right.
He was this black guy. He was a free black man. He owned his own land. He did whatever. He did what his counterparts did, who were mostly
yeah.
white slave owners, white wealthy guys. So if they wanted to beat their wife, which was a major thing, you know, him beating the Whoopi character, do whatever, right? That's what they did. So I didn't look at it as negative image of the black man. I looked at it, this black man was a reflection of society and the society he was living in at that point. And he was mirroring and acting in the way that he saw men of his stature, of his position in life, acted.
And this guy in Congress, what's his name, Roy
Moore?
He would fit right in for the Color Purple.
Right.
Listen, I was watching a movie the other day, The Whistle Stop Cafe, and it was really very interesting movie. I got more out of it as I've watched it over and over again,
mm-hmm.
and it was about really think about almost a homosexual relationship, you know, that wasn't that because it couldn't be done at that particular point in time. But what happened was when some of the white guys got beside themselves, they were put into a pot to be cooked.
Okay. All right.
So it's interesting.
All right. Yeah.
And I watched
like,
that three or four times.
Okay. Sounds like a very, very interesting movie. Someone listening in, I don't know if a caller, if you want to say a little bit about the conversation. I'm going to open your mic if you want to say something. If not, you can continue to listen. It's a 973-325 number. I'm opening your mic right now. Hello, caller.
Are you there?
Hello. I guess you don't want to talk. 973-325.
Oh, are you talking to me?
Yes, I am. I noticed that you
I was asked to call in at K. I was asked to call in at 5 after 8. It's Barbara Kukla.
Hey, Barbara, how you doing? How you doing?
I'm doing
sorry.
Great.
I didn't know that you would be – we kind of slipped our mind a little bit that you would be calling in tonight. And Barbara,
I
know –
brand new book.
As an author, and we're going to talk about your book in 1 second, but I know that you probably have your take on a lot of these issues that we discussed. I wish I had noticed you earlier because I certainly would have liked to get your opinion. But what do you think about some of the subjects?
Well, we should bring
that. What do you
Barbara,
think about some of the stuff?
Wayne and Byron first.
Say,
Barbara is a well-known journalist, a writer. She knows more about jazz in Newark, New Jersey, and in New Jersey than anybody I know. And she has a brand new book out, and I'm looking to find it right now. I just put it back up there, but in my shelf. But Barbara, how are you?
I'm great.
Barbara. Yeah. Okay. What's your book about? Jazz.
Well, I've written. This is my sixth book. It's my third book on jazz. The one you have is America's Music, Jazz in Newark. That came out 2 years ago.
Yeah.
My current book is The Encyclopedia of Newark Jazz, A Century of Great Music.
What should we know about the book?
Well, I think it's the history of jazz in Newark, and it's important to know that jazz, other than New Orleans and Chicago, Washington, and New York, that Newark was a very important jazz city, and particularly for its size, from 1925 to 50, we were a manufacturing town. We manufactured a lot of beer because we were on the Passaic River, and consequently,
yeah.
Before television, people who worked in the factories as a manufacturing town would go to neighborhood taverns. There were 1,100 of them in 1935, not just every corner, but all over the place. And so to sell beer, the owners would bring in a piano player, maybe a trio, and or we had several major clubs, and Ken Gibson, who was our mayor in 1950, he was our mayor in 1970, but in 1950, when he was a kid, he played professionally in a band with Wayne Shorter, who's won Grammys. And I happen to have that picture on my latest book. It took me 10 years to find it. We have
and name some of the other old, you know, musicians.
Well,
yeah,
Sarah Vaughan,
we just had
the Sarah Vaughan International Jazz Competition, which attracted singers from all over the world. At New Jersey PAC. It was the concluding day of the James Moody TD Jazz Festival, TD Bank Jazz Festival at PAC. There were three fabulous events, and Sarah and Moody are pictured on the cover of my book, and I was there with the books on Sunday, and they're on the cover of this latest book, along with Miss Rhapsody, who got me involved in this when I was a kid reporter at the Star-Ledger. And through her, as Newark's oldest singer, born in 1902, I met all the guys in the Basie Band, the Ellington Band, long before I knew anything about Newark jazz, and then met all the locals. And we had quite a number of locals, Willie the Lion Smith, who was a stride piano player, his rival Donald Lambert, Moody, of course, Wayne Shorter came from here, and as I said before, has 10 Grammys. Gratian Moncure III, he's not a household name, but he is the architect of bebop jazz and a wealth of other people.
And you said that James Moody was from Newark? I didn't know that.
James Moody was born in Savannah. He lived in Pennsylvania, but he came here as a young kid. And they thought he was hard of hearing. They thought he was deaf, and they put him in the Bruce Street School for the Deaf, which was not a very great environment for a kid who really wasn't deaf. But he began playing before he went into the Army. He went to Eastside High School and Arts High School. So did Sarah. Sarah went to Eastside first and then to Arts. And, of course, she was discovered at the Apollo Theater in 1942, and Billy Eckstein was there that night and signed her up right away to play with Earl Garner. He was with Earl Garner, the famous piano player's band, and then she went with Billy's band a year or so later, and of course became one of the greatest singers in the world, jazz singers.
Yeah,
she could sing.
Yeah, I knew Sarah Vaughan, not to cut you off, but I knew Sarah Vaughan was from Newark, but James Moody has always been someone who stood out in my mind when I was a young man. I didn't really follow a lot of the contemporary jazz at that particular time, but I had the chance to work with a young man. His name was Frankie Crocker, and he used James Moody, Moody's Moody's Love. The only way I knew about James Moody, you know.
I remember. He did the song that was on the jukebox at the Bridge Club on Washington Street. There I go, there I go. It was a takeoff on I'm in the Mood for Love, and he did the scat. That was his version that sold probably a million or more records. He recorded it in Europe, but it became very popular here, particularly within the black community, where everybody and his brother practically knows the words to this thing. And so
well, Frankie
Moody,
used to play that so much, one would think he was getting paid for it, you know. But
maybe he was.
Yeah,
who knows?
Maybe. I don't know. I shouldn't say that. With all due respect. Yeah.
Sure.
Why you want?
What else do you want?
Well, we're in a season of telling all, Eric. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Listen, Wayne, remember when Bill was on Second Avenue? I found out about Frankie Crocker when he was running down the stairs, the back stairs of LIB, I guess it was. Because there was
the Isley Brothers beating him up, or you know, there's so many stories. But I'm sorry, I don't want to take away from.
Go ahead, Barbara. What else do we know about Newark jazz?
Okay, ask me a question.
Well, There's a pregnant pause here. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. In all honesty, I really admire James Moody's music, and Sarah Vaughan. I don't think much has really been said enough about her. You know, she
well,
was
no,
really
actually, their book,
significant.
There's a new book. Yes, there's a new book about her by a professor from Washington State. I think basically, you know, if not a jazz fan, you may not know about it, but to the jazz world. Sarah is constantly played all over the place. You can listen to her any day. Of course, in this particular book, I outlined some of the key venues in Newark. And of course, we had Savoy Records years ago, which recorded Charlie Parker and all the big names of the bebop era. They recorded a lot of local people like Robert Banks, who was considered the genius because he was the accompanist at one point for Dionne Warwick, a great friend for Dinah Washington, and is a great friend of Dionne Warwick. And for a small town, relatively small, major American city with never more than even 500,000 people and less than 300,000 right now, we've produced musically, and we've produced everybody from Whitney, Sissy, Dionne, Melba Moore, my friend, one of my best friends, Gloria Gaynor, who graduated from Southside High School, and also, of course, Moody Shorter and all the jazz people, Queen Latifah. They're basically ours. They're born in Newark, or like Latifah,
yeah.
Like, hang out in Newark, and know everybody. So I've been very fortunate to know some of the biggest names in jazz from the time I'm a kid, which is now more than 50 years ago, and to travel with them. I was a friend of Al Casey, who was Fats Waller's guitarist. Clyde Bernhardt, the trumpet player, played in 1931. He played with King Oliver, who was Louis Armstrong's teacher. Johnny Williams, the bass player. These are not Newarkers. These are big guys from outside of Newark who were at the roots of jazz. But Johnny Williams played on most of Billie Holiday stuff, played bass. And I was hanging out with all these people through my friend, Miss Rhapsody. And this is my sixth book on Newark, and I have two more on the pot. But my very first book was called Swing City, Newark Nightlife, 1925-50. It was done by Temple University Press. Bill Cosby called me at my house not to invite me anywhere, but to give me the jacket. He dictated the jacket notes to me. And when I put the phone down, I had no proof that he had called me. When I called Temple, I could have made that up. But I did meet him in Atlantic City, and everything that he wrote was basically, you know, that's the old saying: if you don't know, you know, your history, you don't really know who you are.
That's true.
Newark has a fabulous jazz history. We don't have as many jazz clubs right now. We do have the Priory on Friday nights, which is the old St. Joseph's Church on the bend on West Market Street opposite St. Vincent Academy. They've been having jazz on Friday nights for a good 20 years now. It's if you like jazz or any kind of music, it's free, and you can have dinner for $8. So it's a really they're really good soul food, basically chicken, fish. And sometimes they have meatballs and other things, but you can't get any, you know, less expensive than that. And it's a great night. There's a bunch of regulars that go there. Many of these people have provided me pictures for my books. I have pictures that nobody else sees. Sarah Vaughan's adopted sister. As part of one of the 10 essays that I did in this latest book, what it was like to live in the same house with Sarah. Most jazz books are pretty much the same. You see the same pictures of Louis Armstrong or Sarah or whoever. My books have pictures that nobody else has seen. Sarah with her parents. Sarah sitting at a bar when she's underage in Newark with her girlfriend Doris Robinson, who happened to be the person to dare her to sing at the Apollo Theater and set off her whole career. There's a lot of misinformation in some of the other books. Most people say that, she went over and she won the contest. Well, Doris Robinson says that she went with her the first time and Sarah chickened out. And so she played the piano and sang and won second prize, which was $15, and they split it. And then she was invited back. And, of course, she won that time. And it shows you you have to be in the right time at the right place, because that night, that's the night Billy Eckstein was there. If she had won the first time and came back, the prize was $25 plus a week's appearance. But if she, that would have been over, Billy Eckstein probably wouldn't have been there. She might have been back in Newark for the rest of her life. Who knows? But it's like anything else, you know? I'm sorry.
Hey, Barbara, this is Eric. Hi, Barbara, this is Eric. How you doing?
Good.
My mom just pulled out your book. I'm doing good, thank you. Pleasure to talk to you again, as always. My mom just pulled out one of your books, Jazz in Newark, America's Music, Jazz in Newark, A Comprehensive Jazz History of an American City. But I want to ask you, as someone who's younger, about the Swing City reputation or name that Newark, that you gave Newark in the book. So you're saying during this time period, it was really a kind of a jazz capital city? Is that correct?
Well, that goes back to the early days in the 30s and 40s. That's when we had the Thousand Taverns. Yeah, there was music all over the place. You know, plus you had Savoy Records, which was recording people as early as the 30s. And you had even Al Henderson, your mother remembers him, the photographer. I'm sure he took your picture. Al started off as a bass player in a band with Clem Moorman, who was just passed away at 101, Melba Moore's father, stepfather.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I went to see him play last summer. He was 100 years old. He's still playing once a month. Yes, Kay?
Yeah, Barbara, I just ran into Melba Moore, you know, a couple of weeks ago in New York at a party.
She's always in Newark. She's in all over the place in Newark, you know?
Yeah.
But she lives in... one of those towns on the river, not Fort Lee.
About where she lives.
And so Newark really rivaled West 52nd Street here in Manhattan, I guess.
Well, that was the street that never slept. That was big time. But see, what happened was a lot of the guys were coming up from the south to work in the factories, and they found that very quickly there was so much music, if they could tootle a horn, they were okay. Or they were coming up, even comedians like Red Fox came on a train. They were kids. They were afraid to go to New York. It was too big. Newark had plenty of work. It was friendlier. It was cheaper. And a lot of the guys like Charlie Parker and the other ones came here to record for Savoy. So they were hanging out all in the clubs. They were influencing these young guys from Newark. And if you worked in a factory, wouldn't it be easier to go around the corner and work in a local club rather than work in the factory all day long, if you could make as much money in tips. So there was music all over the place. In those days, we had music in the schools. Everybody, Ken Gibson played, I forget what he played, he played saxophone in high school. They used to have Broadway shows at Central High School where he was.
Wow.
When you watch TV, when I was a kid, and your mother and I were growing up, there, the early TV, they had all kinds of variety hours, and it all was packed with music. Nat King Cole had a program. Eddie Fisher, a popular singer, had programs. But music surrounded us. Now the kids barely have a lick of music. The budgets have been cut, and music is one of the first things to go. So
shameful.
So the music does not come out of the clubs anymore. The music comes out of the Newark Museum that has, for 50 years, has had a summer jazz series on Thursday afternoons, and they're still going strong, and they try to bring in some of the names from outside of Newark so people can get a wider glimpse of what's going on in jazz. New Jersey PAC is loaded with jazz programs. WBGO has an art gallery. They have artists come in, and a lot of them are jazz artists or people who do pictures of jazz. They do a lot of concerts, and they stage events at various places in Newark. So we still have an active jazz scene, but nothing like that club scene from 1925 to 50. The 40s, Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. So why would you hire a band for your tavern if you can go out and get this newfangled contraption, TV? So one of the guys on West Kinney Street put a sign in the window. Jackie Robinson versus the Giants. And he had been paying for musicians to come in. Now he doesn't have to worry about them being late, not showing up at all, maybe getting drunk or, you know, things like that that happened in those days. And and he could pay for his television very quickly. So this kind of music started fading out at that point in time, and R&B was coming in. So the changing times, the music changed, and for a while we didn't have that much jazz, and then the bebop stuff started taking hold, and we started getting guys like Wayne Shorter and Tyrone Washington, who was a fantastic saxophone player at Arts High School, but he dropped out. He became a Muslim, and he decided, I don't know why, because there are a lot of other Muslim guys who were musicians, but he decided to drop out and just stay with preaching. And but we have a there are hundreds and hundreds of people in my books. That one has the one you have has a very short list of biographies in the back, but the newer book now has 250 profiles of guys from Newark, and I'll never get them all because there's no record necessarily of people, and then if one of their friends doesn't mention them or they've been dead a long time, I may not have been able to get them, but I've got a lot of them, and including band personnels and local venues that are listed, essays on New Jersey PAC, WBGO, the Terrace Ballroom, where everybody gussied up and dressed up to go to all these clubs and organizations, again, particularly in the black community, that held their dances there. And Ellington and Basie and Cab Calloway, those guys would come in and they'd actually hire them to play for these dances. And so the Terrace Ballroom has a rich history. Later on, I saw Carmen McRae there, and I don't know how many other how many other famous people that have played Newark. And so we are a very important spot on the map, but we're not the only one. If I had more time and I wasn't working as the Newark editor at the Ledger for so many years, and I was at the Ledger for 40 years, I would have done Philadelphia, Baltimore, Detroit, Cleveland. These are people that have rich histories, too, that have faded away, and that's what I do with all my books. I have a woman's book that's coming up next year in the spring. It's called I had a first book called Defying the Odds, Triumphant Black Women of Newark. This one coming up is called Newark Women from Suffragettes to the State – from Newark Women from Suffragettes to the State House. I just got done. We had a very long lunch with Sheila Oliver, Kay and I have known forever, and is now our lieutenant governor. But she is the highest-ranking woman in New Jersey now. Last spring, the highest-ranking woman was Teresa Ruiz, who was our senator out of the North Ward and works for the county like Sheila does. But there's a tremendous amount of history here. I've also done six calendars. I just did one on I can't think of the subtitle, but it's called Remembering Newark's Religious Leaders. And I've done calendars on jazz, gospel music, you name it. I'm doing a book now, right now. I've got three books going at the same time. I'm selling the jazz book. The women's book is ready to come out. And I'm doing another one called, it doesn't have a title yet, but it's about Newark sports. So I've been to every high school looking at every single yearbook, which is a mess because half of them are missing. I happen to be a member of the Newark Athletic Hall of Fame, so I'm going through all their journals. They're missing half of them, and I'm rounding them up for them. So this is my passion. It has nothing to do about money. It's very expensive to do this. This last book cost me five figures, more than five figures.
Wow.
It's not – people want to know how you're doing. They really want to go ka-ching. They're not buying a book, but they want to know how I'm doing. Okay? They're interested in the money. I could care less about the money. My thing is, as long as I'm able to do this, I happen to live alone, so during the winter time, this fills my time. It's something I love to do. I've been what they call a digger or a researcher all my life, including on the paper. So I am very interested in the history of Newark people. I also, and Kay knows this, I wrote the first book on women because Connie Woodruff, who was a huge wheel in Newark, wrote for the Black newspapers, was a founder of the Black Parade, the Crispus Attucks Parade, was appointed by six governors, was on Shirley Chisholm's board. Connie was my best friend. I wrote the women's book because I wrote all day long, and people wanted me to write a book about Connie when she passed away 20 years ago. I didn't want to write. I was still young, and I didn't want to write all day and write all night, so I did a calendar, We took that money. We made $18,000 profit, and I started a jazz competition for Newark kids at Arts High School, and we gave out $4,500 a year for 4 years in prize money, and to keep jazz going. And that's the way we got the kids to get involved. We had Bill May, who was head of art and music, run around to the schools and talk to the teachers, and they'd say, "Oh, our kids don't want to play jazz." And then they'd say, "Well, the top prize for a band is $1,000. The top prize for a singer or an instrumentalist is $500. Every kid gets money. $1,500, $250, and then an honorable, 100 honorable mention. Every kid, we fed them, we gave them jackets. We hired kids at Arts High School to be the photographers, the ushers, and anything else we needed help with. So we really, you know, involved our kids.
Yeah, Barbara.
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 Barbara. This
listen,
is yeah, Barbara. This is Byron Saunders, and
have 2 minutes.
Got a couple minutes, but I'm gonna be quick. I love what you're doing. I just want to share with you that I am currently working on a documentary, called Dangerous Rhythms. It's about jazz and the underworld, a 6-part television miniseries. I just Facebook-friended you. I sent you a message in your message box with my phone number. We need to talk. I sent you the document on all 6 of the series. This is a high-profile documentary top-notch cast of filmographers, and
great,
that I think you'll be quite interested in, so let's talk. But I love what you're doing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Barbara, listen, thanks for coming on. We'll have you on again. The book is absolutely fantastic. I'm recommending it to anybody. It's not even a fat book, but it's a heavy book, and it's America's Music, Jazz in Newark by Bob Kukla, rather, a comprehensive jazz history of an American city. I wanted to say something, too, about Amiri Baraka, who developed, as you say in your book, a long and poetry program based on themes of political and social oppression. And you know Amiri and Amina are singers, and as a matter of fact, I had Amina and Amiri on Kate Thompson Live.
Well, they're featured in my latest book. They're featured.
On YouTube.
They used to run a jazz club, Kamako's Blues People, in their basement. That's featured in this particular book. Abby Lincoln, their good friend, lived with them for a year. So there's pictures in this book of Abby, her former husband, Max Roach, other famous people at events at their house.
Barbara, gotta go.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on. Gonna have you on again, okay? Love you.
Great.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is a very important book, you know, and as she said, so many other books. But Amina and Amiri, you know, when I did the show, you know, with them, that was in Jersey City, and of course, Amina and Amiri, boy, he's known. The autobiography, Love of Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka, and Digging. And he was quite a character. And he was a philosopher. He was a speaker. He was a writer. Amiri is known in Newark, New Jersey, and in New Jersey for a whole lot of other things. Books, poetry.
All right. That's about the end of the show. I want to thank Barbara Kukla for coming on. Sorry that we kind of forgot that you were on hold there. We got so heated in our discussion. But Barbara also has a great political perspective and the many things that she's involved in, having worked for the Newark newspaper. I want to say thank you to our resident historian, Brother Byron Saunders.
Peace and love, my friends.
It's been real once again, my brother.
Thank you.
Again next week. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
And once again, the legendary newsman, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Once again, it's been all that.
Thanks again, Eric K. Byron. I just want to get something in quickly. We're marching silent protest Sunday, November 19th, to Trump Towers from El Barrio in Manhattan. A silent procession for Puerto Rico's relief and restoration.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
That's
thanks.
Right.
Make 10 a.m. to
go ahead, Wayne.
No, I was just saying it begins at 10 a.m. in Spanish Harlem, and we're marching all the way down to Trump Towers, 10 a.m. Sunday.
All right, great. Thank you. And we just want to make sure that everybody goes out and supports that effort and lets the guy in that tower know that he's not doing his job unless he's taking care of all of American citizens. Thank you, Wayne Gilman. I want to say thank you to everybody for calling into the K Thompson Live Show, listening into the K Thompson Live Show. We're on every Wednesday evening live, 8 to 9 p.m., and our show is also archived, so you can listen to old episodes, episodes you might have that are favorites or information you want to get. You can listen to them anytime at blogtalkradio.com/K Thompson Live. I'm the son. My name is Eric Payne, Citizen Payne. You
and
are.
I'm K Thompson. Join us every Wednesday, 8 to 9, on Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you, everybody. Good night. Peace. Take care. See if the music comes on this time. There we go. I got it.